This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Did you know that Otto Frank, the father of Anne Frank, had repeatedly tried to emigrate with his family to the United States after the Nazis came to power in his native Germany? Each attempt failed due to immigration restrictions put into place in the 1920s. Two-thirds of European Jews were killed by the Nazis during World War II in a systematic, relentless process that still exceeds our ability to comprehend its origins and its consequences. The final solution, which was the Nazi plan to exterminate all European Jews, wasn't implemented until 1942, but Hitler's government had begun openly dehumanizing, harassing, and attacking Jews upon taking power 9 years earlier. Even when the Nazi death machine kicked into high gear, America kept its doors mostly closed to Jews like the Frank family, as filmmaker Ken Burns, Lynn Novick, and Sarah Botstein recount in The U.S. and the Holocaust, a new three-part documentary series airing on PBS. Some people lobbied to open the country to refugees in the run-up to war, but anti-immigration legislation, the economic devastation of the Depression, incredulity toward a press that had trafficked in false atrocity accounts during World War I, and deep-seated anti-Semitism, especially in Franklin Roosevelt's State Department, combined to thwart those efforts. I talked with Burns and Novick about why a nation of immigrants remains so deeply ambivalent about newcomers, and the lessons that 21st century America should draw from our country's response in the lead-up to the Holocaust. Here is the Reason interview with Ken Burns and Lynn Novick.
Lynn Novick, Ken Burns, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you for having us.
So the series begins in the early 30s, and it's actually, you're talking about Otto Frank, who is known to everybody as the father of Anne Frank and kind of the person who brought the diary to notice. But it's in Frankfurt, and Otto Frank is, you know, what you're talking about is his plans, his thwarted plans to bring his family to America. Why is it so important that, you start the series with this question of Otto Frank not being able to bring his family to the United States at the very beginning of the Nazi era?
You know, we started out to make a series about the United States and the Holocaust and what was our relationship to what was happening in Europe and what did we as Americans know and what did we do about it, just collectively. And while we were working on the film, which has been many years in the making, some documents came to light that showed Otto Frank, Anne Frank's father, writing to friends in the United States asking for help to get here.
Right.
And that was just extraordinary for us to recognize that the story of Anne Frank, we thought, or I'll speak for myself, but I think most of us felt this was a story about the Holocaust that happened over there, had nothing to do with America. And here's one of the most recognizable stories of the Holocaust has a lot to do with America. So we decided to frame our film around that idea by telling the story of Otto Frank and his efforts to get to America to help our audience sort of see themselves in this story.
And in 1933, it's the Depression. It's about a decade after the Johnson-Reed Act, which was the culmination of 40 years of legislative activism to shut down immigration, particularly from Central and Southern Europe. What's going on with the way immigration was restricted a decade before during the Roaring Twenties? How does that factor into what's going on next?
It's huge. So there are two important things about immigration. One is symbolic, like what kind of country are we? You know, are we the Emma Lazarus, give us your tired, your poor, a nation of immigrants? Or are we an almost equal reaction to that? No, let us stop this. So between 1870 and 1920, millions and millions of people come from areas that are threatening to the Protestant majority, and they want to figure out a way to go back to an earlier time, always impossible, and when it was a dominant. There was a fear was that these newcomers who were from Central and Southern Europe, Catholics, and Eastern Europe, Catholic and Jews, would they be replacing us? And so the Johnson Reed Act is an attempt to essentially set quotas from the countries, the minuscule quotas from the countries that are less desirable, and bigger quotas of people from the Northern European
who, ironically, but are not emigrating in the numbers where, you know, so Germany gets big quotas, but not that many people are coming, and then places like Italy get very low quotas, and a lot of people want to move here.
That's exactly right. So what we have is a kind of, as the situation in Nazi Germany develops over the course of the 30s, you get a terrible, terrible bottleneck, which is you have got a lot of people, particularly Jews, who are trying to leave the ever-expanding German area, Germany and then the Rhineland, then Germany, the Rhineland, and Austria, and then the Sudetenland and Czechoslovakia. And we are saying, no, you can't come in. And so you've got all this space to let others in, but you don't have space to let the people who most desperately need to get out. And so just our Johnson Reed Act is going to contribute significantly to the fact that the United States isn't going to be able to do what I believe they should have done, which is let in 10 times more people than they did. And that would have been an important, important aspect. We could have absorbed them. We could have taken them. But it's also the Depression. Yep. The demagogues are out there, anti-Semitic demagogues. People say these people are here to take your jobs. They're already a conspiracy of Jews to control absolutely everything. The New Deal is not the New Deal. It's the Jew Deal. Franklin Roosevelt, who is, you know, for some people, the enemy because he's anti-Semitic, is in fact called Rosenfeld because it's presumed he's a Jew by the anti-Semites. So you have a very tragic dynamic going on in the United States that is going to ensure that the place that is able to accept so many people is not going to do that, and you compound the humanitarian crisis.
And it's also the Johnson Reed Act or the immigration acts that were passed in the 20s are the culmination of a kind of mental map or a reimagining of American, not just American identity, but human identity. And you guys go over the work of Madison Grant, who's known for writing a book called The Passing of the Great Race, who comes up with this kind of crazy schema of Nordics, Alpines, and Mediterraneans, which then influences. So, I mean, not only that influences the laws in America that keep people out from undesired countries, but it also influenced Hitler and the Nazis. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think he's looking at the United States and he's saying, look, you've handled your native problems so well. You've gotten rid of them, or you've isolated them into essentially big concentration camps. He hasn't yet devised that system. He thinks the Johnson Reed Act is terrific because it's favoring his ideal of an Aryan race. I mean, this is the absurdity of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, the Russian hoax that gets promulgated by Henry Ford. It's the insanity of eugenics, this pseudoscience, and the insanity of Madison Grant, that there is any kind of distinctions based on race or ethnicity or nationality between people. There's one race, it's the human race, and that's it. Everything else is an attempt by people to other somebody else. And for, you know, the United States, it's Black people, it's Native people, it's immigrants and Jews. And for most of the world, it's some variety of that, Catholics in some cases in the United States earlier. But it's also Jews have had this experience because they are stateless for millennia. And they are always the groups that have come in and helped organize things in a civilized sense, but they run counter to the tribal sensibilities that people often return to in times of stress or under the influence of authoritarian demagogues.
The question of refugees is also interesting because from the inception of certainly of the Johnson Reed Act, and there were refugee situations, you know, prior to World War II or prior to the 30s when people are looking to get out, particularly of Nazi-dominated parts of Europe. What was the attitude towards refugees, kind of the official attitude towards refugees, and where does that come from? Because it's a subset of questions about whether you're pro or anti-immigration, but we've had and we still struggle with this today, a very vexed relationship with the idea of refugees.
It was instructive for us to understand the distinction in our foreign policy between immigrants and refugees. So immigrants, we think of, are people who are coming to live here, to move here, to resettle here. Refugees would be, in theory, people who are fleeing persecution or imminent peril, and we would take them in for a while, and then they would theoretically be able to go back to where they came from when the conflict was over. That was sort of the general idea. The United States did not have a refugee policy during this period. So there was just this immigration system that Ken was talking about with the quotas from country to country. There was a lot of talk in the press and in politics about refugees and that these people are desperate and they need help. But there was no special exception made in this sort of immigration policy for people who would just come here temporarily. And, you know, there was also, as the sort of situation devolved, a growing fear that immigrant/refugees who came from Germany or from Nazi-occupied Europe were a threat, that they would undermine our national security.
Right. The fifth column.
Right. So these are people who you let them in, and then they sleeper cells, you know, that kind of idea that we're familiar with. That was very much a fear then. And there were German spies in the U.S., for sure. And we had spies in other places. Spying is part of, you know, human conduct. But the idea that Jewish refugees fleeing Hitler would become the most dangerous threat to America.
So that we had to essentially keep them out virtually completely.
Keep everybody out. In other words, like, we can't let any of these people in because some of them might be spies.
Right.
You know, I think we appreciate the fear at the time, but there's also fear mongering.
Right. No, and there's a dark, I mean, the Holocaust and certainly a lot of Jewish writing coming out of it is, you know, the darkest humor, but you know, at the same time, we're worried about Jewish refugees, like Nazi spies coming in on them. There's a growing Bund movement, which is openly pro-Nazi, not even pro-German or anything.
This is the absurdity of all of that. And I think that there are historical antecedents, because remember, so many of the people in the big wave of immigrants were Catholic and Italian and Central and Eastern European, and they're often fleeing persecution or abject poverty and would qualify really in the kind of refugee as well as immigrant status, right? And they're now, with regards to the Bolshevik revolution, they're now all communists. So what you have is...
So you're fleeing communism, but you can't come to America
because you're a communist.
Right.
And that you're fleeing pogroms that have been taking place, but because you are Jewish and because communism is now being equated by the Madison Grants and the Henry Fords as equal, communist, the Jews bringing communism, that they're responsible for the Soviet Union's collapse. You just have this conflating of all of that, and you have the poverty and the worry that people are just here, they're not like us.
Right.
And that's the big distinction.
Schrodinger's immigrant. This is a popular meme that exists today, that immigrants are simultaneously coming here and they're just going to live off of us because they're lazy and they take welfare,
or
they're coming here and stealing our jobs.
May I tell you that in the middle of the 18th century, Benjamin Franklin lamented the arrival in Pennsylvania of the swarthy Germans. And that he wanted to keep Pennsylvania for the lovely white and red, meaning the people whose land we were already stealing and dispossessing and killing were now being romanticized along with the white race that should be there. And that somehow the Germans, who would later suggest that they were the epitome of the white race, were somehow swarthy and not desirable. He wanted to keep
Pennsylvania. He may have been onto something there, but you know, now that history has revealed. So, well, it also brings up, you know, one of the antecedents. So you have this immigration policy and a set of mindsets, plus the, you know, economic realities of the Depression going on. Also, America's experience in World War One. That's also important, and you talk about that as a precursor to all of this. What, you know, by the early 30s, what were people thinking about World War One and America's relationship to it? And how did that affect how we thought about what was starting to happen in Europe?
Well, I think there was a lot of anti-German propaganda during World War One to get people motivated to go over there and fight. And a lot of it was later proven to be untrue. It's grossly exaggerated talk of atrocities. And so there was that memory that we were lied to by the government office that created this propaganda. You know, so that sets up a dynamic where people are very suspicious of the government wanting to get us into a war, especially after we've been promised we're not going to get into the war. You know, for the first few years of World War One, America's told they weren't going to have to worry about it.
Wilson won by saying he kept us out of war.
Exactly, and then a year later, now we have to get in. So You know, that's not that long ago when we're talking about the 30s. And there were even hearings, I don't remember exactly, but the late 30s, right, about this war profiteering. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the sense of corruption and being lied to and the sort of the government not being trusted to keep us out of war is very potent by the time.
70, 80% of the think that World War I is a mistake.
Right.
And so you've also got a large German population in the United States that's been villainized, right? You've helped to pass prohibition by making the German brewers the kind of the enemies and the
along with the immigrants who are drinking, right?
Who want to drink, whereas us abstemious Protestants don't need that. We can give up the bottle. And what we're anxious about are Catholics with their sacrament, blacks with their bottle of booze and the ballot. And so you're trying to regulate, and eugenics is a perfect example of how you can, in a scientific way, justify these kinds of absurd theories. But what it does is it just creates others, people that aren't us, even though we're all us.
And it becomes complicated as we move forward, because World War II is a radically different war than World War I, right? I mean, there is a strong argument still to say, like, you know, the United States could have gone in equally on either side.
In World War I.
World War One. And, you know, it really wasn't our fight. I mean, it's a more powerful argument. Yes. But that's very much.
But not that those sentiments aren't there. There's great German sympathy. You know, Henry Ford is going to pass up a contract to make military things for the Brits and instead takes a contract with the Germans. People are interested in not, you know, choosing sides or favoring perhaps what they think is going to be the winner.
I mean, because more people are descended from Germans than any other ethnic group, I think, still, but certainly at that point in America.
Joe Kennedy, who's the ambassador to the Court of St. James, said it best. He says, you know, Britain is doomed, right? He's sure that Britain cannot survive the power of Hitler. So there's really a question of let's stay out of this, but let's be on the right side if we, you know, at the end. And that makes this very, very complicated for a time. But this is a totally different war.
Right.
And this is a war based on, you know, they're both after German expansion, but the other one is based on these racial theories of finding the Lebensraum, the breathing room, so that you have to treat the Slavic people as not people, stateless people whose territory, like Native Americans, this is not their land. They're just occupying it. There's no sense of a political entity that gives them. These are people that don't really deserve passports. And a passport is that piece of paper that identifies who you are. And so this is the area that we'll take. This will be our big breadbasket that weakened the German people, minus the Jewish Germans and Austrians and everybody else.
And one of the stats that you, it comes up at several points, but in Europe, by 1945, two-thirds of Jews are gone from Europe.
They've been murdered. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to add on to what Ken was saying to say that, you know, the up until we got involved in the war, the country was, there were a lot of people here who admired Hitler. Right. And, you know, not just because the trains ran on time, certainly the society was portrayed in the press. There's Christian Science Monitor and other mainstream publications saying this is a very well-run place. And yes, they sometimes go a little overboard, you know, with sort of being too violent or oppressive. But basically, you know, this is a good example for us to follow. And we have the Olympics and the kind of big sort of stage managing of that. They're incredibly brilliant with the propaganda. So we look back and we see the evil and the depravity and the barbarity. But at the time, you know, our nation wasn't 100% on board with that until the war kind of progressed.
And that's also, I mean, America at the time was kind of a mess, right? I mean, you know, FDR did his bold, persistent experimentation, which kind of worked, kind of didn't. But there was a sense we needed some kind of structure and forward momentum that Hitler, Mussolini before him, and then Hitler was delivering.
Like, right in the 30s with the Depression, you have the sort of collapse of the global economy of a certain order, right? So then is it going to be fascism? Is it going to be communism? Is it going to be democracy? Which of these systems is really going to prevail? And that's an open question in this country.
Right. We focus on the mythology of the only thing you have to fear is fear itself, which is, if you think about it, not a really logical thing. Yeah. It's an emotional truth, and we get it, and it was smart. But the real point of that speech is when he basically says, you know, I will ask Congress for the power to fight this economic emergency as if we were being attacked by a foreign enemy, which causes Eleanor to go, whoa, what do you mean? And there is a sense in 1933, as FDR is coming to power, that maybe a democracy or the Western democracies, as we understood it, are ill-equipped to face this economic crisis. And the example of Mussolini and Hitler, kind of brutal authoritarian regimes, are the way to go. And there are people who are urging, you know, Franklin Roosevelt to become a dictator. And he's understanding that it's going to take bold powers to do something, you know. Somebody said to Roosevelt early on, you're either going to be the best president or the worst president. He said, if I don't succeed, I'll be the last president.
Let's dial in a little bit on the lack of trust in media and then a bit in government. But you were talking about the kind of propaganda stories that came out of World War One, and then were later kind of debunked or like, okay, we're being played here because the government and media is kind of telling a story that may or may not be true. How did that work out in the early 30s? Because there are a number of people who are sounding the alarm early on. And this is also before certainly the mass killings began. That's later in the decade or even in the 40s. But, you know, how were people consuming media at the time?
It's basically, you know, three elements. You've got a newspaper, you've got a radio, and you've got newsreels on the weekends when you go to the movies on Saturday or Friday night. Americans are reading newspapers. There are, you know, the argument is that we didn't know. We knew there were 3,000 articles about kind of German treatment of Jews in 1933, the first year. I mean, there's coverage. I would not overplay the suspicion about it. It is there, but I think people trust it. It's hard time to believe, and you're also distracted by so many other things. The Depression is the number one story of the 1930s, and so while you could say, "Oh boy, that's too bad," when you hear about the train crash in India or the flood in Pakistan or whatever it might be, you're saying, you know, how am I going to get food on the table? Who's going to do this? And if they want to come here, does that take my job? And people are accentuating that. There is alternative media in much the same way there is here. There's Father Coughlin. There are people, right? There's Henry Ford with the Dearborn Independent that's
which
promoting.
Which is the place that actually published the Protocols of the Elder of Zion.
So Henry Ford is a virulent anti-Semite. Yeah. He believes that Jews are responsible for the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. He buys the Dearborn Independent that grows to the second largest circulation. And he promotes this Russian hoax, the Protocols of the Elder of Zion, which is, you know, just recounting the ancient sense of Jewish domination of everything, banking and whatever. And he prints it as the International Jewish Conspiracy and over many, many weeks, and then publishes it a book. It's translated into languages, including German. So it has a kind of effect in the United States that I still think we hear the echoes and the reverberations of it today in the way you can have the kind of disassociative thinking that comes along with anti-Semitism, you know, that they are conniving and they're smart and they're but bad smarts, as the scholar Deborah Lipstadt says, but they're also ugly and they're unattractive and they're mean-spirited, but they're also virile and they're going to take our women. So you have...
But then they're also effete and they hire other people to do their work
so
for them.
So you have all of these, you know, incredibly racist tropes about Jews that just aren't true. And they persist to this day in the sense of people just beginning to see it. You see it everywhere. You see it, you know, in the extreme left as well as the extreme right.
You know, and this is a kind of an absurd question, but how much of the in the run up to a kind of American indifference to what was going on in Europe and to the beginning of the Holocaust, and then it was because it's the Jews and there are not that many of them and they really are different than us, you know, whether we're Catholic or Protestant, who, you know, hate each other, but sometimes they can be like, well, you know, but we are very different. We're categorically different than Jews. How much of it is just that if this had been happening to people in England, or if it had been happening to the Irish, say, would we have responded the same way?
That's a really good question. I don't know how to answer that. It is a little bit of a parlor discussion, what if the South had won the Civil War kind of thing. I don't know. Jews have had a special relationship to humanity for a long time, a people without a country until 1948. And so there is a sense of them bringing things that are unifying, that connect other countries, a kind of globalist and internationalist thing, a sense of, as the scholar Peter Hayes says, they have brought the notion of fair play and the golden rule. They've brought lots of ideologies that
bring Christianity but refuse to participate. They kind of have transnational things
in them. And so they become a perfect scapegoat when you've got an authoritarian person who wants to scapegoat somebody or to blame the ills or to return to the more simplistic but self-destructive aspects of nationalism, of tribalism, and things like that. So it's hard to say. I think there would probably be more sympathy for the Irish, but, you know, the Jews have had this going on for millennia, literally, and have heard all of this a million times, whether it's Father Coughlin or, you know, 1,000 years before Father Coughlin. There's a reason why you have to get rid of the Jews now, because they're doing something.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's hard to really generalize about the American public's response to all of this, and it does tie into the questions of how it was covered in the media. And people could be concerned. Kristallnacht, which was this horrible pogrom that happened, you know, out in the open on the streets of Germany, was front page news.
Right.
You know, it was an outrage around the world. Roosevelt made a statement. You know, there was a sense of this is wrong.
Yeah.
So it's not indifference per se. Right. It's more a sense of, well, this is really wrong. But like Ken was saying, it happened over there. It's another catastrophe, another humanitarian problem. We can't do anything, or, you know, we have our own problems here.
Right.
So there's just a sense of recognizing it's wrong. I think probably most Americans did. Even anti-Semitic Americans would probably recognize that, you know, you can't just go around beating people up in the street and burning down their houses and taking their stuff, you know, for no reason. But it's not really our problem.
Right.
Or we care, but we have our own problems. So there's just, you know, it's, we tried in the film really to unpack the nuances of this so that it helps, for at least for us, to understand all the things we have to deal with today.
Right.
Because we face the same challenges. Right. A photograph of a Syrian child drowned on a beach is horrible. But what are we going to do?
Yeah. Can you talk about Rabbi Stephen Wise a little bit? He's a figure who comes up and is a central figure in kind of motivating Americans to kind of give a shit about this. Who was he? And what were some of his most successful efforts to bring attention to what was going on in Europe?
Well, I think that he is the most famous rabbi in the United States by far, and apparently mail came to him just rabbi, you know.
Yeah, you
USA.
Have that thing where the post office would deliver like letters to rabbi.
Yeah. So,
and it would be like, oh, it's got to be going to
Stephen
New York.
Wise. Yeah. And he took on himself, and he seemed to carry the burdens, it seems, of the great dilemma, which was for American Jews and Jews in the rest of the world, the dilemma of, if you speak out, do you imperil the Jews that are still in Germany? If you don't speak out, are you complicit in what is happening to the Jews in Germany? And so you can see it etched in his face. He does have, because of his renown, access to the White House. He's able to speak out. He's brought information about the earliest reports of the beginning of the decision to exterminate the Jews of Europe in the killing centers in Nazi-occupied Poland. It is buried by the State Department. It goes to a British member of parliament who gives it to Stephen Wise. He begins to go public with it. So he becomes the face, the sort of vanguard of information about how bad it's actually going to be. And it's really hard for anybody to get their minds around it, because nobody could actually believe. You can see the sort of, you can understand, you know, what happens in a pogrom, you know, of Kristallnacht. It's terrible and it's whatever. But the idea that a state would say, you know what, we've got 11 million problems, let's get rid of all of them. And that they're successful with two-thirds. I mean, they were successful. They essentially eliminated the Jews of Europe, and those that survived got, for the most part, the hell out of there. So Stephen Wise, I think, is a way to understand one aspect of the American Jewish community's anguish and their their desire to try to do something, to figure out what was the best thing. And you have, I mean, Kristallnacht itself is interesting. It's not an American-sponsored moment, but you have a young, stateless Polish Jew in Paris who kills a minor foreign service person in the German embassy, and that's the pretext, right? There's an international conspiracy. See, we told you. They're out to get us, so we're going to get them. And this is when things begin to transit from making their life difficult and trying to get them to leave to beginning to say, maybe we just get rid of them.
And this, I mean, is kind of at the heart of the series that, you know, at a certain point, Germany may have been amenable to just getting, letting or forcing Jews to leave, but they're not coming to the United States. They're not allowed in.
They had all kinds of plans. That was really fascinating. Different schemes. You know, some of them completely preposterous, Madagascar and different things. Just, we're going to just put people on boats and get them out of here, just deport them to different places.
And then you recount, I mean, the famous story of the St. Louis, which is a ship of Jewish refugees that comes to the New World, comes to Cuba and America and is just turned away.
Yeah, well, we tried. That's a story that has come down with some understanding and some misunderstanding about what was really happening there. There were lots of ships. You know, we did have this quota system and some people got here. So as more than any other sovereign nation, we let in 250,000. A lot of them came on boats. Right. So there were boats coming across the Atlantic before America got involved in the war, you know, here.
Yeah.
And they had, people had to have visas and they had to have permission. It was really hard to get. So sometimes they would try to get to a different country and then hope to get to America.
Right.
So the St. Louis was a ship of 900 and something refugees who had gotten visas to go to Cuba.
Yeah.
And the idea there was you get to Cuba and then you wait until your number comes up and you come to the United States for most people.
But you're safe.
But you're safe. You're out of, exactly. So they get to Cuba, but when they get to Cuba, the Cuban government decides, you know what, we don't really want you here and your visas don't count anymore, even though you bought them. Right. So now they're sitting there in Havana Harbor and you've got a whole media circus going on. You have relatives coming to the ship. It gets a lot of attention and it kind of symbolizes the whole refugee crisis. And here they're only 90 miles from the United States. So, you know, why don't they just come here? Well, they don't have visas to come here. There's a quota system. There's
and
all
you
kinds.
Have, you tell a heartbreaking story. It's hard to even kind of put these in terms of a guy who saw the lights of Miami on the ship.
And asked his dad
and
where
then
it
ends
was.
Up,
and he ends up in the United States.
Yeah,
and so, you know,
and
real
those points, I don't want to make too much art out of this story because that seems wrong, but the series is filled with those kinds of moments that are just revelatory in an amazing
way. Arguments don't work. Yeah. You don't change anybody's mind. Stories, you do. Stories, you have a thing. And if you've got a little boy asking his dad what the lights are there and it's Miami, and now as an American Jew, having survived all of this in great dramatic fashion, by the way, to have spent time in Miami and know what that's about is really important. What's missed in the St. Louis is what Lynn is saying. First of all, there's no way that it can stop in the United States because of this this pernicious Johnson Reed Act. And, you know, FDR is not a king. He can't wave a magic wand. It's Congress that would have to change it. And they are in no mind to do it. The interesting thing, though, is that the St. Louis sails back across heading to Germany. Its own German captain is thinking of running it aground in a free country. And more importantly, the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee comes up with the money necessary to essentially buy their entry into five nations, you know, Britain, France, Belgium. Those people go there. What's unfortunate and tragic is about a quarter of them are then killed when the Germans subsequently overrun their country of sanctuary. But it's an instructive story of how much these tropes of the Holocaust and the tropes of the Second World War get misunderstood. We presume that there is therefore an essential anti-Semitism inherent in FDR, who appoints more Jews than anyone else, that he doesn't help in this regard, but he's doing many other things. He's a cold and calculating politician at times, and that doesn't look so good in retrospect, but that there are other sort of mitigating factors. That's what's so interesting about it, is that you can take something in which people have a kind of superficial understanding of it. And more often than not, huge parts of that are misunderstandings and complicate the story with what really actually happened.
Hey, before we continue with the recent interview with Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, I want to talk to you about today's sponsor, BetterHelp Online Therapy. Are you having trouble solving problems in your life? Are you anxious? Are you depressed? Do you need to talk it out? Start talking to a licensed therapist who's not going to judge you, but will listen and help you with your problems, whatever they are. Anxiety, depression, lack of motivation, you name it, they are there to help. BetterHelp is cheaper than most traditional forms of therapy, and it lets you talk with your therapist via chat, phone, video, even text, all within 48 hours of signing up and without any of the hassles of in-person appointments. I know that BetterHelp Online Therapy is a great service because I used it myself for the better part of 2 years, and it was convenient, it was affordable, and most of all, it was effective. So go to BetterHelp.com, BetterHelp.com/TRI for the Reason interview, and you'll get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp.com/TRI. And now, back to the Reason interview with Ken Burns and Lynn Novick.
But let's complicate the story about the government, too, because the State Department is absolutely, is it ideological anti-Semitism or, but there are people in the State Department.
That's the correct way to say it. There are people in the State Department who are virulent anti-Semites.
Yeah, and talk a little bit about that, because that's part of the reckoning, right? That needs to be done if we're going to take American history seriously.
Part of it is the culture of the State Department and the culture of official Washington and where it came from and who gets those jobs and, you know, sort of the power of the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant establishment, if we want to call it that, you know, to run these institutions. And Roosevelt comes in and starts to shift things around, but still the State Department, as we say, is hidebound. It's sort of, you know, this old-fashioned kind of gentlemanly, courtly environment of diplomacy and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, the people running it are not focused on the refugee crisis. Mm-hmm. They're focused on international relations and, you know, not alienating the German government, for example, you know, before America gets involved in the war. So it's from the top down. There's not a sense that someone, you know, Cordell Hull running the State Department is saying, hey, you know, job one is let's relax the rules to get as many refugees here. Far from it. And then you have Breckinridge Long, who's the head of the Visa Department, which is the agency, the part of the State Department that actually in the consulates around the world, you go in to apply. And they're the ones, the guy sitting in front of you at the desk is going to say yes or no. Do you have all the paperwork? Have you got everything in order? Now, you know, do they have to follow the letter of the law to every single I dotted and T crossed? I mean,
and he was,
maybe.
Yes, and he misrepresented.
He's the black hole where information about the impending Holocaust goes to die, where information about individuals happen of a bureaucracy that then begins to change the rules. Many of the German and Austrian Jews have connections to the Western democracy and to the United States, and they have means, and they are fulfilling this obligation that you not become a ward of the state, that you've got recommendations that there's an amount of money, and Breckinridge Long and those of his ilk in the State Department are constantly changing the bar. So you will find somebody who's gotten all their stuff together, and then all of a sudden there's a new rule and you kind of almost have to press reset and do that. And that this is where the United States is incredibly has to come to terms with, has to recognize.
And we didn't fill the quotas that we had even.
This is the amazing thing. Right. So we take in 225,000 human beings, more than any other sovereign nation, but we got so much space. It would be in sports salary cap. We have so much space that we could have brought in at least five
following
times
the
that
rule
number.
That we have, right.
Following
right.
the rules that we had, had it not been for the kind of perfidy of the State Department, individuals in the State Department. And it's going to take a Treasury Department starting the War Refugee Board, run by Henry Morgenthau, who is Jewish and a friend of Roosevelt's, to be able to do it. And even then, State Department kills that for months and months and months, and finally it happens, and it becomes the most effective organization in saving Jewish lives in the story of the Holocaust. But finally, it takes us so long and so late to get started that you've already lost more than three quarters, probably more than 80% of the people who are going to be murdered in the Holocaust have already been murdered by the time the War Refugee Board gets started.
One of the historians that's in the documentary, a fair amount, Peter Hayes, talks about how the speed with which the time when people were being killed is immensely compressed.
Yes. It is.
18 months or 20 months or something like that.
Yeah, that's so shocking in a way. It's how easy it was for them to actually do this.
Yeah. How did people respond, or how did the American government and the American people respond once it became clear, the Wannsee Conference, where the final solution is kind of promulgated, is in the beginning of 1942. By the end of that year, people are taking it seriously, or more so. Like, what happened to get people to kind of say, like, okay, this, you know, forget the World War I propaganda. These stories, which sound kind of similar, this is happening on a much greater scale. How did that perception flip?
Yeah, that was what Ken was talking about, Stephen Wise, and there was the World Jewish Congress in Switzerland was collecting data or evidence from people who came out of the Polish underground to describe what was happening. Because remember, this is happening largely pretty far away from the Western world, right? So,
I think Hayes also talks about how a lot of where this was happening was not reachable by Allied forces.
Yeah, but there's an even more thing is that that Hayes brings up that's really important to understand to help set this in motion is that Hitler wants to get rid of the Jews, right? He wants them out of there. And in more than half of German Jews, 560,000, more than half of Austrian Jews, 190,000, do get out, right? But as he keeps assuming territory, he's got a huge problem, which is as he's getting his breathing room in Poland, 3.3 million Jews, and Lithuania and Latvia and Belarus and Ukraine and the Soviet Union, it's just astronomical numbers. And then you realize we're not going to take over Britain right away. We can't take their navy and ship them all to Madagascar, where we can starve all the Jews to death. Insane plan, right? We're just going to murder them. And so what happens is, and what was a revelation for me, was the Shoah by bullets, in which there are 2 million Jews that are just shot in the head and put in pits all over Nazi-occupied Poland and Ukraine and all of these places. And it's just, it's before anybody has mentioned the word gas. Right. And so I think that when you say Holocaust, you think 6 million, it's very opaque. You can't particularize, as the writer Daniel Mendelsohn says in our film, what that means. He takes his own family, his great uncle and great aunt and their four daughters, and finds out what happens to them. He spends a great deal of his professional life delving into what happened, going to Soviet records and things like that. And only one of them, the mother, is killed by gas. Everybody else is killed in another way, mostly in atrocities that are almost unspeakable when you think about these four teenage girls. So it's an amazing It's an amazing context to understand that the Holocaust is really, we just don't have time to get them out of here. We can just kill them. And let's figure out the most efficient way to do that.
And all for the American story, all of that's happening before we have boots on the ground.
Right.
So essentially, it's what we could have done was to help people get out before all this happened.
Right.
Once it started happening, we, the United States, was not in a position militarily, if we wanted to, not to say that we did, but even if we had wanted to, we're nowhere near these places. Our planes can't get there. We're in North Africa when this is happening. So it's just, we have to line up all the information to kind of, if we want to critique our policy and our government's inaction, it's not about that. That by the time that happened, it was.
And you could say, you can debate whether you should bomb the rail lines to Auschwitz, where the rail lines could be replaced overnight, or do you want to make a mistake, or imprecise bombing would have probably killed prisoners and did when we missed a plant 5 miles away. 80% of bombs dropped in Europe fell outside 5 miles from their intended target. 80% of all bombs, okay, let it go.
Yeah.
is outside of the target for all the obvious reasons, imprecise calculations, but also fear and let's drop it and get out of here. Let's go home. Pilot crews were dying and the American public would probably not stand for the idea that you were diverting resources from winning the war to going to do what? Bomb a rail line to Auschwitz. But the most important thing is the War Refugee Board, that in the last places where the remaining Jews are, that you can do something about in Hungary and Romania, that's where they have their thing. And so Raoul Wallenberg, the celebrated Swedish diplomat, feels that he's funded by the War Refugee Board, and he feels that he's part of an American program, as do others in the community, the international community in Romania and Hungary, particularly Hungary. And so it's a pretty interesting thing that the tens of thousands of lives that we credit Wallenberg with saving, and others, really important diplomats from other countries, Switzerland notably, are basically being underwritten by the War Refugee Board, which is an attempt to step outside the guidelines of the United States and flood the zone with money for forgeries and for bribes and for things like that. It's one of the few places where you can find like the various committees, like the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society and the YMCA and the American Friends Service and the individuals who just pack up their lives and go to save other human beings. That's the points of light that exist in this story in the midst of what we consider the darkest moment in humanity's history.
After the war is won, and there's in one of the final episodes, you quote Eisenhower as saying, like, Eisenhower tours a couple of the death camps, and he says to, you know, broadly to soldiers, or saying something, and I'm paraphrasing a bit, like, you may not know what you were fighting for, but you now know what
a
you
soldier,
were fighting
a
against.
A GI giggles nervously at the horror that they're looking at.
What was Eisenhower, what does that mean to say you might not know what you were fighting for?
He said, we hear that the GI doesn't know what he's fighting for. At least now, maybe, perhaps, you know what you're fighting against. He's talking about the Willie and Joe from Bill Mauldin, the guys who were in the trench, and you're just there for your buddies, and you know that everything is foobar and snafu, and that the bureaucracy of the army is about as big as you can get. But there's now, he's suggesting, and Eisenhower is incredibly great on all of this, and his writings, the formal writings, not just the anecdotal stuff, are amazing. He insists that a congressional delegation comes. He insists that newspaper editors come and look for themselves. He insists that commanders send their troops in their off times to these camps and look and see. And it has a profound effect on many, many Americans who visit there and begin to understand what it was about. And it's to Eisenhower's credit,
absolutely,
I think, that he...
I mean, I think one of the things we found working on a film on the Second World War, sorry about... One of the things we found working on a film on the Second World War and now this project was, you know, what was told to the American public about what we were fighting for, mm-hmm. the four freedoms. It was pretty abstract, really. Right. Nazism, you know, fascism. But I think when the camps were liberated, it was kind of flipping to say, oh, that's what this means. Right. You know, it's not an abstraction. These people have been brutalized and killed and tortured, and we're fighting to stop this from happening.
I think both in this and certainly in your series on World War II, what's powerful about it is that it pulls back some of the gauze that has crept in with the whole Greatest Generation rhetoric, where everybody was united and
they
knew what they
were
doing. Yeah.
First of all, we call that war the good war.
Right.
Give me a break. It's the worst war ever. We name our first chapter of that film A Necessary War. Right. And that may be a better described by one of our pilots. It might be a better way of describing. Sometimes, you know, this is what human beings do, and sometimes this is unavoidable. But once you have the evidence, I think it's important to say that really galvanizes a lot of sense of purpose and helps to help, you know, set in motion, I think, some of the mythology and the barnacles of sentimentality and nostalgia and the Greatest Generation that has encrusted it. But let's also remember that the Americans, seeing the newsreels of all of that, the proof now, the ovens and the concentration camps, the crematoria, all of that stuff, 5% of Americans want to add more refugees to the United States after it's over.
There is a moment where you show a newsreel and they're showing, they're opening up ovens that still have bodies in them or corpses, and the narrator says, don't turn away, look. And I have to say, you know, like I've been watching this stuff for decades because, you know, this is what you do if you're interested in history in, you know, the last 70 years. And I was stunned by it because I was like, no, I want to look away. What goes into, or, you know, what do you do with the fact that faced with this, with the documentary evidence of this mass murder, you know, unthinkable, that it really didn't move the needle in terms of like people saying like, oh yeah, let's, we got lots of space here. Let's bring some more people in.
So yeah, it always seems possible that there's always something that trumps the larger humanitarian concerns, the better angels of our nature. Abraham Lincoln would say, it's always maybe the economy's stupid, right? The war is going to end. We know that the spending's going to stop. We may be slipping back into depression. There's going to be lots of unemployment now, all true, and maybe we don't want to do that. But I think at the end, you have to ask a much deeper question about who are we, what kind of people. I'd like to know a lot about those 5%. You know, that understood, you know, is to me, there are moments more recently, and it always makes me cry, which is in Billings in 1993 in Billings, Montana, some idiot threw a rock through the front window of a family that had displayed a menorah. And the Billings newspaper, I don't know what it's called, printed a full page picture of a menorah. I can't imagine there were more than five you could buy in downtown Billings. And people, Christians, put up thousands of menorahs in their windows. And that is that 5%. And we're interested in both understanding that those people exist. The Varian Fry, a writer in New York who goes and works with a vice consul in southern France, Hiram Bingham III, to rescue Jews. You know, famous ones, Max Ophüls, you know, Marcel Duchamp, Piet Mondrian, but also so-called ordinary people, and that there are all these committees and people working anonymously, but there is a huge part of us not sensitive to the plight, that have bought into in some way, shape, or form, some degree of the sense of an other, and that we're not all part, there's only, you know, Madison Grant is wrong, there's only one race, the human race, and that's the only distinction we have between, that's it. Just human beings. And there are people like Eleanor Roosevelt, her famous, Frieda Kirchwey from The Nation magazine, others who get it and understand what this is about, and others that don't. And it may just be as simple as, I'm worried about my job and that's why I'm not. Or it may be the fact that those elements of anti-Semitism, of racism, of nativism, of xenophobia have been here and will always be here and will manifest itself in some portion of the population.
I agree with everything Ken said. I think there's one other piece that I think about, and it ties into this looking away, is that it's a paradox, right? That we've seen millions of people dehumanized and treated as less than human and exterminated, killed and tortured and just everything. And then when you see the pictures, it can double down on the dehumanizing. And so it can evoke sympathy, but it can also evoke revulsion and horror. And, you know, it's a very complicated thing that's going on here. So on the one hand, it's horrendous and it's a tragedy and we feel sad. And on the other hand, like, do we really want the people that we've just seen staggering around, skeletal and brutalized, to come here? Right. You know, and so it's very complicated. Not to mention the layers of anti-Semitism and othering that's already happened that allowed this to happen in Germany and all the places that Hitler conquered. That toothpaste is out of the tube, and getting it back is really a long process. And so that's the work we're trying to do as a nation, right, is reckoning with all the things Ken is saying, and to kind of restore people's humanity when it has, the whole point was to take it away from them. And then the other piece is the Cold War. So we did let in a lot of refugees after this, right? And the switch flips really quick, and all of a sudden Germany's not the enemy, the communists are the enemy, and we let in a lot of refugees from Latvia, Lithuania, who are displaced people. So it's not like we won't let in any refugees.
Right.
We let in quite a lot, but not the Jewish refugees. And Truman has to intervene to get in maybe 50, 60,000 Jewish refugees after the war. So, you know, this is, there are a lot of layers to this, and yeah, we're still trying to figure out exactly what's going on.
I think that's a hugely important point about the dehumanization means that the same opacity that we relate to the notion of 6 million, which right, is an impossible thing, those bodies also become, those emaciated figures become kind of something that you can't deal with. And what's important, what engages the human heart and human sympathy and human action is a sense that they live a life as real as mine, that they care about their existence the way you and I care about our existence. And that is a step that is still to be taken by a majority of human beings in this world. And that's, I think, why we have literature, that's why we have art, why we have the ideals that we have. And they're, you know, we have not lived up to them, but that has to be what you want to aim for. There ought to be, coming out of this, a sense that, you know, as messy and as kind of screwing up as they are, democracies are the way to go. Authoritarian governments kill more of their own people by exponential magnitudes than do democracies. And that freedom to vote and citizenship are a very meaningful thing, because in fact, at the heart of this, the heart of the dehumanization is taking people who were human beings and saying they first were not citizens and therefore not entitled to any protections of any state, and therefore we are now free.
Yeah, one of the things that is amazing in the opening scene when you're talking about Otto Frank, his family had been in Frankfurt since the 17th century or 16th century. Yeah, which is kind of amazing to, you know, think of.
Well, there's generations of Germans who are Jewish,
right,
who think of themselves as German first.
Sure.
And they're not, you know, practicing Judaism in a very serious way, and their identity is as Germans.
Right.
But unfortunately, this story shows they don't get to choose.
That's right. So to pull it back to the immigration question, you know, it seems like after World War II, among other things, fighting in World War II kind of granted equal status for many immigrant groups. So, you know, my grandparents were Italian and Irish. They were fully American after World War II because they sent sons, you know, to fight. And, you know, people like John F. Kennedy in the late 50s published a book called A Nation of Immigrants. This was the narrative that I grew up with. I think we all did that. You know, somewhere, and it served a Cold War purpose, but it was also describing basic reality. We are a nation of immigrants. Everybody comes here, and that makes America stronger. That narrative does not seem to hold anymore. We don't talk about immigration, or I guess there's paradoxes going on. You know, Ronald Reagan in the late 80s passed or signed off on legislation that immediately created hundreds of thousands of legal citizens, mostly of Mexican descent, who had been illegal. You know, that's good. That was he was very pro-immigrant. The percentage of the foreign-born population continues to grow. 1970 was the low point in terms of the census. So there are more foreign-born people here. There is more anxiety about immigration in the 90s. The California Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives voted on Prop 187 to, you know, ban aid to illegal immigration. It was widely seen, and I think properly understood, as anxiety over immigrants, you know, the duskification of California. Donald Trump, you know, rose to prominence by talking about ending immigration, right? Illegal and illegal. And at the same time, Gallup finds historic highs of people saying immigration is good for the country, even as first Trump and even Biden now have reduced immigration. How do we deal with this, and how does this tie into the larger themes of your series?
I think it's a really important question. And one thing that I've been thinking about, which is not just an American story, which is this: the ideology that Hitler took to the worst, horrible conclusion, you know, demonize a certain group of people, Jewish people and other people too. But that ideology is still with us, mm-hmm. and different groups can get slotted in. And there's been this sort of the far right or the neo-Nazi or the alt-right, whatever words you want to use, basically have kind of substitute immigrants mm-hmm. for Jews in different ways. So there's, you know, that's a powerful thing, and that's happening in Europe. We see it all over Europe, mm-hmm. fear of immigrants and demonization and scapegoating.
And I mean, they right? sadly, I mean, they don't have Jews to blame anymore, right. but now they
immigrants.
Can say
it's, you know, can I just go back and take a little longer view, because it's the central question, I think, of our conversation, which is the Johnson-Reed Act did not address immigrants from the Americas. It
right.
was presumed that the people in the Americans, mostly Mexicans and right. Central Americans, would cross the American border for agricultural purposes
right.
and go back, right? What was interesting is that the corrective to the Johnson-Reed Act in 1965 suddenly placed limitations on those from the Americas while it was liberating the Johnson-Reed Act of its pernicious quotas.
Right, and so LBJ called it, we were righting a cruel and enduring wrong.
Right, now it did not say anything about refugees, and it put on the problems, I think it put on the Mexican and Central American and the American stuff that I think set the seeds for what's going on now.
Yeah.
I don't think we would have all of these problems or perceptions had we just understood our relationship to the Americas. You know, it's a kind of a different kind of Monroe Doctrine that got kind of obliterated as we began to be concerned once again with an othering. You know, you said Dusky, you know, that brown people suddenly didn't seem to be as American as anybody else. And so, I mean, it's very complicated, and I oversimplified it a lot, or coming for the reasons of the brutality of dictatorships there and the poverty and the gang violence and mm-hmm. wish to come into the American system where they would enjoy much more freedom and privileges and support. So a lot of the fears are understandable. The problem is always in the othering. We don't see this as humanitarian issue. We see it as a political issue. We see this as them, not us. Humanitarian issues become all of our responsibility. And that's where I go back to that post-war 5% wanted to let in more refugees. You get sort of have to begin with that 5%. And I don't know how you build a majority, but it's absolutely necessary for us to advance in a humanitarian fashion.
And don't we also see that it's incredibly potent politically? People have made careers on this. So it's striking into something that's very deep, and whichever the group is that's being demonized and othered, other people are gaining power by doing that. So, you know, that there's a dynamic, a very long-standing dynamic that we saw going back to like Benjamin Franklin to now. Mm-hmm. So the laws and the policies shift, but that process,
the path,
endures. Yeah,
yeah. The lowest common denominator, right. that path of least resistance is to demonize the other. And it, I mean, when you listen to Father Coughlin, it doesn't sound too different than what you hear on some radio programs or some TV shows. The virulent anti-Semitism in his case is replaced by an anti-immigrant Mexican in another place or whatever it might be, or in fact, rising anti-Semitism again. The ADL reports that the level of anti-Semitic incidents is at the same level it was in the 1930s.
All right, well, that's a note to end on. So I want to thank Ken Burns and Lynn Novick for talking about the U.S. and the Holocaust. Thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to be here.
Yeah.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please, right now, before you do anything else, go to Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, and sign up. Get this delivered automatically every week right to your inbox. Or make it easy on yourself and go to reason.com/podcast and sign up there. And while you're there, check out our weekly Reason Roundtable. It drops every Monday, features me, Matt Welch, Catherine Menger Ward, and Peter Suderman talking about the biggest issues of the day. And also the Soho Forum Debates, a monthly podcast version of a live debate held in New York City every month that's of special interest to libertarians. Go to reason.com/podcast. Thanks for listening.